There he is. What's he doing in the sky? Where's he gone? There he is. Look at that. Brave little boy. Hello and welcome to the podcast, which is this week a little bit different because it's a video. Look at those little sky cunts up there being brave over the cliffs. How fitting for this podcast, which is themed, I guess, around bravery. Now, my dog is pulling my hand. You see the dog, just to prove that I haven't got some sort of wasting disease or Parkinson's. She's pulling my hand. So this week my guest is Aldo Kane, who is a very interesting man. He joined the army at 16, Royal Marines. 16, can you believe that? Because he wanted to. For years before that, he's got a twin brother who was meant to join the same as him. They went through like loads of stuff together, scouts and everything. And actually, scouts, he counts as sort of like pre-military training. So Hazy's always laughed at me when I bring up the scouts, but Aldo Kane counts the scouts as a legitimate sort of training ground for the army. And I was a very good scout. I didn't get many badges, but you know, I did a once hike, and I was good as a leader. I got some kayaking badges. Anyway, I really can't compare my shit scouting prowess with anything Aldo Kane's done. I mean, talking of Hazy, Hazy reckons himself, and you know, compared to me, he is some sort of like insane adventure man. But compared to Aldo Kane, he's a tubby little gentleman who's never been outside his house, who's got milky fat thighs, and whose mum takes him once a week to feed the ducks in the park. That is how much of an outdoorsman Hazy is compared to Aldo Kane. And if you don't believe me, listen to this. Right, there's people coming, and I've never done talking to the phone while people walk past, so hopefully this won't be too painful, but I'm going to do a little hello to them so they don't become weird. But hi. Just do this all the time, just make videos on my own. Oh god, there's someone else now. This is meant to be quite secluded down here. bear with me. It is Nola, yeah.
Hello, brother.
How do you know her?
Hello. I'm a dog walker.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, you've met. Oh, right.
Yeah.
She's got a better social life than me, I think.
Hello, brother. I was recognised dogs, I've never recognised.
Yeah, well, yeah. She stands out, doesn't she?
Yeah.
All right, nice to meet you. Nola actually knows humans that I don't know, and they know her name. That's weird, isn't it? What was I saying? Yeah, Hazy's a big fucking pussy, and Aldo Kane isn't. Right, so anyway, he Royal Marines, then he trained as a sniper, right? Went to war in Iraq. Didn't die, obviously, but nearly did a few times. Saw proper action. That was what I was saying. His twin brother, when the day they literally were about to leave to get on the train to go and join the Royal Marines, changed his mind and didn't go. Can you imagine that? I don't know if they're identical twins. I didn't get that from him. I hope this wind isn't a problem for the sound. It probably is, isn't it? But deal with it. Look at those fucking things. What are they called? Parasailing? Sending? They look really shit in the viewfinder, but in real life, they're breathtaking. There's also a hawk hovering up there. It's going to not even let you see that. Don't. It's a bird about to pounce on a rabbit. His brother didn't get on the train. His brother, he met a girl and sort of changed his mind. But anyway, Aldo carried on, which must be, I mean, they bullied him, especially the trainer people, they called the, I don't know what they're called in the army, the big guys, the training people. They went like, do 10 press-ups and then do 10 for your brother who didn't turn up and stuff like that. But, you know, if you're a twin, then I think you've always got that, you've always got someone with you, you've always got sort of friend made, you know, naturally by your parents, you've got a twin. But also, socially, you're never really on your own. You go through things together. So maybe that was useful for him to sort of be on his own without his twin. I don't know. But it's quite an interesting part of his story, I think, that, you know, having a twin brother, you're both about to do this thing, and then he fucks off and leaves you on your own. Although his brother did, I think, later on. Look at those guys. That could be Aldo and his brother. His brother did join the army later date when he was older. But yeah, Aldo did it at 16. Sorry, I'm switching hands because Noel is pulling me. Look at her. What a little tart. Joined at 16. Then, what other things did he do? So he was a Royal Marines soldier, then a sniper, went to war, came back from war, realised he wasn't a massive fan of war, and he came out of the army, and there was no real support back then, so it was probably, you know, 20 years ago or something. He tried to be a door-to-door salesman. I mean, basically, he's got a book out. If you want to know all this, buy his book, because it's good. He reads the audio book. Fucking hell, look at that. It's right above me. Look at that. Isn't life amazing? Looks like they've died. Sorry, I lost you for a minute there. He came out. Hey, look, someone's landing. One of them people. Just landing there. Can you see? Over there. Just landed on the beach. Bold as brass. I could go and talk to them. See? He didn't know what to do work-wise, couldn't, you know, struggled to get a career. He had to do the birdie dance at a job interview. I mean, he was, you know, demeaning shit after being an extremely well-trained soldier and sniper. His book is called Lessons from the Edge, because basically, long story short, he ended up being a sort of, oh God, I can't hold it like that. Wait a minute, this is a freaking dog. Right. He ended up being a adventure cameraman, sort of getting film crews into really difficult places like volcanoes. He spent time in volcanoes. He also, I mean, one of the maddest things he did that I, from the book, is he filmed in, I think I mentioned this in the podcast, but he went into Africa to film a documentary about Ebola as it was happening and spent time in the red zones of hospitals where people were dying of Ebola and, you know, boiling hot in PPE, and like basically Ebola compared to coronavirus is fucking way worse because the death rate's something like 80% or something, or 65%, I don't know, it kills, you know, basically gonna most likely kill you if you get it, but it's spread through bodily fluids like blood. Well, I don't need to list bodily fluids, but basically it's fucking deadly and dangerous and easy to catch. So we did that. So he's basically, I suppose, got the opposite. This is why I'm fascinated by people like that. His sense of fear and danger is just the opposite of mine, in the sense that I would do anything to avoid danger. Although I say this to him, I've done stupid things and I've, you know, taken drugs and done things that would be considered dangerous. But things like Ebola and war, I mean, just the words, you just think, fuck that, don't you? But like, he's run headlong into them. And what you might know him from is like TV stuff where he does essentially like fucking hardcore abseiling into volcanoes and dangerous places. So he works out how to get a film crew in there safely. Fuck knows what his life insurance is like. He must have life insurance, and it must be like a mortgage every month, basically. Maybe he just doesn't have it, but I should have asked him. The thing is, we did about an hour and 15 minutes because I didn't tell him that I normally go 2 hours. So he presumed this was a normal podcast, as we know it's not. And so he had to go and see the physiotherapist. So it got cut short. That's why I'm sort of recording this extra bit of video at the beginning. If you like these video versions of the podcast, let me know, because they're no more hassle than the audio version, really, which I will share the audio as well.
Oh, mesmerising, isn't it? Look at that. Lovely, lovely, lovely. Give us a wave. Give us a wave. No, she's gone behind a tree. Come on, give us a wave. It's a bloke. There you go. There you go. feet going then. Come on. Do something good. He's gonna crash. Go on, crash. Show off. YouTube. Oh fuck, where's my dog? Oh, there he is. Go on, crash. Go on, that's it. Oh, he's going fast. I'd like to do that. That looks fucking good fun. This idiot. Oh Jesus, look at that. Look at that fucking thing. Hazy, ID this. What the fuck is that? That looks dangerous to me. Nola. Say hello. Nola. She couldn't give a fuck. What is that? Anyone ID that? It's gotta be that's gotta be toxic, hasn't it? What a funny little walk we've had. Should this be the podcast now? Just me walking around like an absolute idiot. Oh look, I'm zoomed in, that's why. Just being stunned by things. What a lovely day though. Should get outside more. Sitting in my house, going mad. Just come out here. Anyway, that's worrying, isn't it? I wonder if I should kick that and stop a child eating it. Nah. Look, one of them's landing here. I hope you can hear all this with the wind. Otherwise this has been completely pointless. Oh, it landed. The problem with doing things like that, it's a bit like camping. They've now got to fold that all up, put it all in a bag. All that boring shit. It's a bit like nah, it's not like that at all. I was going to say it's a bit like masturbating. The difference between you flying through the sky and then you got to pack it all away, stroke, wipe it up with a tissue. That's what they're doing now. What a silly hobby. That they feel like a right bunch of idiots. They're all brave up in the sky now. They're just people putting something in a bag that's too small for the thing. Frustrating, all the strings getting tangled up, you know, when you've got a kite and you have to put it back in the bag. This bloke can't even be asked, he's just fucking off home with it like that. He don't care. I might talk to him. I might say something. I'm gonna find out what it's called. Hi mate. What's it called, what you're doing?
Paragliding.
Paragliding, right. Okay, I was thinking parasailing.
Parasailing is
utopia. Ah, right, got it. No, right. Looks good fun.
It is, yeah, the wind's not great today.
Oh, right. How much is one of them?
Second hand, 500-600 quid.
Oh, really? Can anyone do it? Can you?
Yeah.
You need a license?
It takes a while. I mean, you're meant to have one, but plenty of people don't.
Yeah.
But, you know, it'll take you a couple of months to get down a bit.
Right.
A couple of months of getting dragged round fields.
Right, so you don't go off the cliff straight away. Oh, right, okay. Great fun though. Cheers, mate. There we go, putting them back in their bags. Actually, the bags look massive. I might have to nah, look at that, the orange bloke. Fuck that. Putting that back in the bag. No, thank you. Well, what a lovely walk we've had. Yeah, I'm a vlogger, bitch. Deal with it. Anyway. Fear, bravery, the military mindset, get up and get at them, that sort of thing. I wish I had a bit more of it, but in my own way, you know, I have to get up and get at them, but it's just not physical, war-like behaviour. I have to do it. I have to go to war every day against scripts and edits and meetings and notes. But we all have our battle, don't we? Even if we're not out there giving the Germans a bloody nose. So, yeah, fascinating guy. I think I've set him up well enough to say, here we go. Here is Aldo Kane.
This just feels insane. Whoa. That is, without doubt, Mission Impossible. I used to be a sniper in the Royal Marines, one of the hardest sniper courses in the world to pass. Oh my God.
Same as all these expeditions are self-rescue.
Get in! Yes!
We can't rely on other people to get us out of here.
Come on!
Let's go! Oh! You're good! There's some huge rocks in the rough down there.
Alright, we're filling up with water, guys.
This is the modern day gold rush, really, and staking a claim on a piece of land to dig, exploit, and then leave behind. As an adventure, it was amazing, but it's also quite sad. This is the earliest that the sea ice has broken up on record.
Kibo Mango just said, normally, due to lack of discipline, you wouldn't be allowed to train for not bringing your PE kit.
Oh, right.
So you're going to have to do it in your pants.
Listen to that noise. It's like thundering ball.
This is a new threat that wasn't around when I was a soldier, when I was fighting. Akapoko is one of the most violent places on the planet at the minute. That was the deepest part, and it's bloody cold.
What?
I feel like I'm, like, you know when someone's on the news on a Zoom call, it just feels like that. And I start looking around my screen and stuff, but... I think,
for a massive, massive vibrator on the back shelf.
Yeah, you do need something like that. I mean, I like the fact there's a lot of family albums, photo albums in your wanking room. That's good.
It's on me.
Yeah, that's good. So the book, I've read the book now.
What do you think?
It's really good. It's really good, yeah.
You have to say that.
No, well, I mean, I wouldn't go, it's shit. But it is good, and it is, and as I've made notes and stuff. But like, what I think's fascinating about it is, as someone who, I wouldn't say I was a coward, but I'm like, I have hypochondria, I overthink stuff, I sort of, you know, I mean, yeah, mildly cowardly, but sort of like my life has been trying to avoid, you know, danger, really. That's most people's is really, but like what I'm interested in with you, because you're quite, because you're like dealing with danger all the time, or you have been in various situations. I don't think you realize how different to the average person that is, or maybe you do, but in the book, it's like, oh yeah, we were under fire. And I'm in a volcano and all these things. And so I'm interested in the mental control to not be going, like so many situations in the book, crossing the Atlantic, where when you, like the bit in the book where you say we're going past the Canary Islands and it was almost like, oh, we could stop, it's dangerous. Like at that point, what is it that makes you go, no, let's keep going instead of, oh shit, we could all die here. This is stupid. Let's go. We could be pissed in an hour in a club.
It could be, I don't know, maybe I'm too much of a coward to like, bail out. I don't know.
So it's a different type of fear, a different like failures, the fear.
I think, you know, my job is you know, looking after film crews in extreme remote and hostile locations around the world. And you know, that could be anything from with Foxy out doing the Narcos stuff to exploring a cave system in Papua New Guinea to running a Himalayan whitewater river. So it's quite like, I have quite a broad spectrum of like jobs, but I'm kind of like a jack of all trades. But my, you know, the reason that I do this job or the reason that people ask me back to do this job is because I have that step back approach to like, what is the hazard? You know, we all get mixed up in everyday life about
what risk is, and you know, it, you know, the hazard is the thing that's going to bite you in the ass. You know, the hazard is is the dog or the hole in the ground, right? And the risk is the likelihood of that happening. And you know, sometimes it's about making that risk assessment in your head. It's like, well, the hazard is a road traffic accident. If I don't put my seatbelt on, you know, I could end up in an accident and I could end up dead. So the consequences is high. So that's why you wear a seatbelt. If you're inside an active volcano, you're looking at the hazard as a lava bomb hitting you on the head and killing you. But the likelihood or the risk of that happening is minimal. It's minimal. It's minimal if you take into account all the mitigation sort of thing. So, you know, I think on the outside, it looks like, you know, taking excessive risks. But actually what I do and what people in my job do is control. We're like control freaks. We try and control as many parts of our environment and our situation as we can. And by doing that, it gives us an element of control, even in a situation that is completely gone awry and out of, you know, like if everything's fucked, but you can still make a decision and pretend that you've got some semblance of control over it, that's good for your head.
Yeah.
And I guess that's the same in everyday life, you know?
Well, when like controlling variables, like I'm pretty good at like assessing risk and just in general life, I wouldn't, you know, like, mind you, I've done some stupid shit in my life, but like, you know, just sort of thinking, I don't know, that's survival mindset of like, right, that could get stolen, that could get broken, that, you know, like car accident, what happens if, you know, these heavy things in the back shunt forward, all that sort of thing, which is just sort of like a slightly neurotic mindset. But the difference, like say you're in a volcano, then the variables are natural. And so they're sort of predictable, or, you know, predictable, unpredictable, right?
Yeah.
But when you're doing narcos with Foxy and you're dealing with human beings who are on drugs, who are jumpy because they're, you know, drug dealers, like that's not something where you can assess the statistical risk, is it?
Yeah, you're right. You know, I did a job just over a year ago now, and we were in a sort of volcano system down in the South Pacific. And the person that we had there was a very high value Hollywood actor. And to a certain extent, you know, the consequences of something bad happening are catastrophic, as they would be for anyone, right?
Yeah.
But it's kind of predictable. The lava bombs are always like 98% of the time landing in one sort of 500 meter area of the volcano. You can kind of make up your plan based around that loosely. Yes, there are some oddballs that get fired out and land close to you, which would be a showstopper if it hit you, but it's kind of not the norm. Whereas working with the narcos is you've got, you know, it's the worst recipe. You've got people that are on using, making, transporting, trafficking drugs, cocaine. So the stakes are already high. They're already at the bottom of their socioeconomic rung, which is, you know, on the ladder, which is why they're doing it. You know, their countries, governments, etc., have failed them a lot of the times, and this is all they have as an option.
Yeah.
They also, you know, some of them also further up in their sort of middle layers have an ego, and then they have weapons. You know, so that's like the worst.
Why do they agree to be on? Because there's nothing. There's no benefit to them. Do they just get paid?
No, not at all. No. With Foxy's thing, Foxy asked me if I would go down. It was like his payback. He was like, you know, I'll help my mate Aldo out because I helped him out back in the day with something. And anyway, so I ended up down in South America with him doing this show. And I think, you know, the biggest thing that we noticed is that they have an ego. You know, they're almost untouchable by the law enforcement, and they have an ego. You know, one bit, Foxy's interviewing this guy, this hitman, and you know, behind him on his wall in this like safe house is a picture of Al Pacino and Scarface. You know, like, so they,
yeah,
you know, there's definitely like a sort of crass ego sort of thing, narco cultura down there that you know makes them want to, you know, it makes them want to glamorize that sort of lifestyle. But as we know, the reality is actual brutal murders. Acapulco, when Fox and I visited there, the morgue had I think the morgue in the city was for like sort of back in the day, old dude dying in his sort of budgie smugglers on the beach, you know, and there was like space for 15 people. Whereas now, you know, there's like 50 odd bodies in at a time. The fridges when we were there weren't working, just like absolute chaos. And that is, you know, that's the reality of it all.
Mm.
But yeah, like you say, it's harder to, that's harder to make a judgment call. You know, it's hard making judgment calls on people and your friends and, you know, your wife. You know, you live with someone for however many years and you still get it wrong.
Yeah,
yeah. You get that wrong with a narco, then, you know, or these gangs, then, you know, you end up in trouble.
Yeah. Has it ever gone wrong?
On that one, we sort of, Foxy and I, we planned every day, we planned to like within an inch of its life. It's like that old adage, you know, Foxy and I were in the Marines together, and you know, you train hard, fight easy. You train for all the eventualities and you plan for all the eventualities, and then you hope that, you know, actually you don't need to use any of it. So we sort of spent a lot of time in planning and debriefing and making sure the next day, you know, we had everything covered, because we were dealing with such, you know, if we were going to a meth lab, for example, you know, it would just be, you know, they would just phone up and cancel that trip that day. And, you know, we just had to go and do something else.
Mm.
And, you know, so it was very, you know, it was very flexible. We had to be flexible, but our main drill is about staying switched on and not getting separated and not making sure that we had overstretched ourselves or leveraged ourselves too much during that was like key. So, but yeah, it didn't go catastrophically wrong, because we, you know, we got back from it, but
yeah.
You're under no illusion the entire time you're there working with them that if you were to make any mistake of judgment, then, you know, they'd kill you.
Yeah. But, I love that bit. The thing in the book about the button, having a button undone, why is that important? You know, coming up through training, because I was a scout. And I mean, you say in the book how like dib, scouts, dib, dib. Yeah, I know, everyone used to say that. But like, we never said that at scouts.
I never said that either. I don't know. It's like
my granddad used to like, oh, dib, 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 dob, dob, dob. I didn't know what it meant.
I don't know.
I did have a woggle, though. That was the other thing. People go, where's your woggle? And that was the thing. But when we used to do, you know, a jamboree or like a camp or whatever, and then you had to have your stuff inspected and your clean, your pots had to be clean and all that. I fucking hated it. And I was just like, this is pointless, sort of just seems like bullying. I don't get it. And then, you know, when you get older, you realize, well, there's a reason for that. But I think you really summed it up well in the book of the, you know, one loose button, what do you call it? A submarine hatch. It's like
submarine hatch.
Yeah.
It's basically like what that, you know, in the book, what I'm talking about there is attention to detail. And it's, you know, some people might say, well, what's the difference? You know, you leave a button open, you leave such and such open. But if someone's leaving, you know, in that walk of life, and certainly in my job, you know, if someone leaves a carabiner undone or leaves a bit of rope lying out and people are walking on it, that draws my attention to it, because it's attention to detail. It means, what else are they, you know, the button is not going to cause anyone any harm, but it's, if that isn't being done, what else isn't being done? And what's that, isn't there a famous thing about M&Ms? It's the same thing. It's like, you know, and the reason wasn't because they were picky. Who was it? Led Zeppelin or something?
I don't know. I don't know if it's even true, but it's like, yeah.
Might just be a urban myth.
Yeah, but the thing was, they said, we want M&Ms, but without any of the red ones or whatever it was. And so they knew if that was being done, everything else was being done. So it was.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, in the military, you know, you get smashed, you get hammered for having a button undone, or like an Irish pennant, they would call it, which is like a little bit of thread, you know, like from where the stitching finishing. And that attention to detail is actually it sort of analogous to someone who's doing their job properly and correctly, even though it's, you know, it's a button. Sounds weird, but you know, so like in the narco stuff, you know, Foxy and I would make sure all of our shit was absolutely wired, you know, and that means that, you know, we both know each other. We know each other from quite a long time. We know our background and what we're capable of and what our flaws are. And, you know, and that started probably in the scouts, you know, like you say, the scouts are teaching you to clean your pots and pans, basics, but you know, you wouldn't believe how many people I go away on expedition with who will, you know, who will have their food or whatever and just leave their pots lying around under their hammock in the jungle, and they'll wake up in the middle of the night and they will have literally a freight train of ants underneath their hammock. So it's just about little bits of discipline, and you know, it could be a curse as well, like my missus probably hates me for it, but you know, like I don't leave things lying around, the house is like always tidy.
My wife would love that. it's like, but what I am interested in is that like military mindset, right? So that is drummed into you. You weren't like OCD as a child. So that is just drilled into you. It must be like, because you and Foxy have got that, you just know that he's got your back. And in real life with, you know, civilian people who've never had any training, people let you down constantly in little ways. They're late and stuff. Do you find normal unmilitary people annoying?
I'm quite... I suppose I'm quite ruthless with my own sort of set of rules that I stick by, and I'm quite forgiving with other people. So I'm strict to myself, and you know, forgiving with other people. But yeah, certainly, you know, I'll rarely be late, and I'm always, you know, I will expect other people on expedition or on trips to be the same. And it can be a bit of a curse, but really it's the same again, attention to detail and, you know, timings, all that sort of stuff. I'm not a stickler about it, but when it comes to my job, then that is the difference between life and death. You know, if we are fanning around inside a cave and it's raining outside, like in Venezuela, it happened, you know, and we're, you know, a day and a half late getting out of the cave and the cave's starting to flood, then, you know, that's a bad day and that's bad admin as well, you know. So there's quite a lot of these things can be mitigated against by just being organized.
I think that's like true. I suppose like you've done the extreme stuff, but where people can sort of in their everyday life relate to it, it's like, you know, doing a podcast. If I've prepared, I've read your book or listened to your book, I've done, you know, like I feel so much less stressed out, but like I naturally push. I think, oh yeah, that takes 5 minutes. I'll do, you know, and it all just crumbles. And then it's like, so I'm quite envious of that military mindset where you just, I don't know, like I've always thought like I could kill people, but I couldn't get up early enough. People shout at me. Like that's the things that put me off being in the army. Not that it was ever a consideration. But getting up early and not having enough sleep. You know what I mean? Like constantly being tired and having to shit right next to someone else, or like have no personal sort of private space. Do you know what I mean? Like those were the things. It was never
That sounds exactly like parenthood, doesn't it?
That's true. Yeah. I didn't go to the toilet by myself for a while. When they're tiny and they've like, you've created them, it's not as bad. But when it's some bloke that you're, you know, I just think.
I think it's, you know, it was 10 years of my life was being in the military and scouts, I guess, before that. But, you know, there's a softening off period as well when you come out, because you just can't live like that, you know, all the time. Yes, I like, you know, clean house, clean digs. And I'm organized and on time, but like quite a lot of the other stuff slips because there's just no need to. Exercising is one thing that doesn't or hasn't slipped, you know, that it has been instilled in me since I was probably 14 or 15. And then doubled down in the military for 10 years. And so now that's just like, it's a way of life. In fact, if I don't exercise and I'm not getting out running or training regularly, then my head space is all over the place.
Yeah.
Literally shit.
Yeah. That is, so like for me, it's like I go through little bursts of it, but when I'm exercising, it's like, oh, why don't I do this all the time? It's like the most, I mean, it's so annoying because it's what you were told as a kid, really, that I'll like, go for a run, my dad used to say, and I think, what the fuck does that mean? But it totally does sort your head out. I think we just got a lot of energy that we don't expend because we don't have to survive like we evolved to. So we can sit around watching TV and then wonder why we're hyped up and anxious.
I think that's, you know, we as human beings, bear in mind, I'm not a psychologist, but like, you know, we operate well when we're busy in a state of flow. Like, you'll know yourself from work, when you're busy with something that you're passionate about or you're interested in, like stuff just, you know, you're just like balls deep in it and it makes you feel good. And you know, when we're sat potentially at a desk or a job that you don't like, you're not exercising, you're not eating right, like all these things have a knock-on effect. Doesn't mean that, you know, I'm boring and I don't go out in the pace and you don't do all that stuff, but I just know that there are little tiny basics that it's like life hacks, you know. Like for me, a run or a bit of training every day keeps me just below like boiling point. And so that, you know, so when someone cuts you up on the road, for example, you're not going to lose your temper and flash because you've already got rid of some of that temper. Yeah. You know, you see it in London a lot. People are so hectic running around, you know, and always busy and shouting and swearing at each other at like 6:30 in the morning in the street sort of thing. But also that is a luxury of time, you know. Time to train is a luxury. And, you know, you see fit Instagram influencers who have created this life for themselves that allow them to train for 3 or 4 hours a day, but the normal person doesn't have that luxury. So, you know, you're lucky if you've got 30 minutes between kids waking up, jobs, like dog need and walked, all of this other stuff. So really, you know, that all the stuff that we're busy doing isn't good for our head or our mental health.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you say that because my wife was just away for 2 weeks, I told you. And it's like between the kids, they were at school most of the time, but like then they were ill, and then taking the dog for a walk and then making sure that the laundry's like it's, and I was meant to be working as well. It's just like, I was a wreck after that. So like,
has she come back and saved you though?
She's come back and saved me, but there was a period of such bad jet lag where there was a crossover of like, right, you're back. Wanting to just throw children and a dog at her, and she's like, well, I don't even know what's going on. So there was an interlude where it was like, come on, wake up. But no, she's back. But like that sort of stress, like just a lot going on. What I found interesting, I mean, Foxy says it in his book actually, but I mean it's true, I suppose, of all soldiers, is like as stressful as being in a war is, and I'm not comparing what I've just been through. 2 weeks with two is a bit like Iraq. But like you've got in the army, you've got most of the decisions of your life taken out of your hands. Like you know, Foxy said that in his book about he didn't know how to book a dentist appointment when he came out. Yeah. So like, I guess there's a flip side where in the army, you've got all this stress and stuff, but at least it's contained within one area and everything else is being handled by...
Yeah. By the powers that be. Yeah. But it's the same, you know, I probably touch on it a bit in the book, but like Steve and I are Foxy and we'll always be talking about it, Steve Batchelor, is like, why is, you know, the stuff that most people are scared of, you know, and you know, spending 18 hours a day up to your neck in a mangrove swamp somewhere where there's crocs around and the stress levels of it, like, why is that to us easy and then the real life at home then becomes difficult? And it's like total, you know, it's flipped on its head.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just through years of being conditioned into operating in extreme environments, but after a while it becomes a norm, and that becomes, you know, finding comfort in chaos becomes your sort of go-to in a way. And you know, certainly for me, you know, learning new dad, you know, learning new skills. Like, I don't know how my missus does it, but that is you know, my actual stress levels are probably more stressful, you know, doing something fairly mundane that, you know, my wife is used to doing every day than I would be if I was, you know, rigging a 400 meter abseil and about to drop off into an unknown sort of wadi or something. So it's, yeah, it's strange. But certainly in the military, you have a lot of these decisions taken out your hands. So you don't need to worry about mortgages, booking a dentist, you know, paying the rent. You know, it's all just done for you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, like, the when you are in a stressful or, you know, seemingly stressful situation, I think you have that focus because you have to focus. And then I think normal life, so we're sort of primed in an evolutionary sense to hunt and to do certain things where you need focus, and you're, like you say, lost in the moment. You're sort of in the moment. And then sitting on a couch with two kids and the TV's on and you're worrying about a mortgage and you're getting emails, it's, you can't be hyper focused on that situation. It's too much going on.
Yeah, it's frenetic.
It's frenetic and abstract things. It's like, oh shit, I need to do that thing, I've got to do that. It's not like, right, we're hunting this deer, we have, you know, like, I feel like, yeah. I don't know, I mean, it's
it's not going to get any easier, like, for the next generation. You know, there's just so much going on, and you can be in five, you can literally in the future be in five places at once. You know, you could be sat in a Zoom in the metaverse. You know, Facebook have just been banging on about that. You know, like, we're going into this weird exponential age where, you know, where kids are going to have to be, you know, not only multitasking, but, you know, multi-lifing almost. You know, you can have one outside in the normal world and one inside this weird sort of frenetic computer world that we're just dabbling in at the minute with social media, with emails, and, you know, with jobs and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's weird, because, like, in your book, you're saying how at a young age you connected with nature, you were always outside hiking and stuff like that, and obviously that is just not the youth of today. I mean, like, I'm sure that, I know there's pockets of that around, but, like, generally people are on video games and phones and, you know, TV screens and stuff like that. I wonder what, like, the standard of kids that are turning up to sign up for the army is like now.
I don't know. It's always been, you know, when I joined the Marines and did the sort of basic training, there was always, when you passed out and went to your unit, people would always say, oh, you know, it was harder when I did it. And, you know, and people before them would have said it was harder when they did it. But, you know, like, soldiering changes, it gets more technologically advanced. You know, there's a million things now that Marine recruits would have to do that we wouldn't have had to do back then. In theory, the physical tests still stay the same. The commando tests still stay the same. And the structure is still roughly the same. But, you know, for example, when I did that drone film, I made a film about drones and how drones were being used, you know, by terrorist organizations and could be weaponized.
Yeah.
And I was out in Dallas filming, and we were speaking to a you know, this tech company that made this kit, which was a laser, which basically located a drone from 5 miles away, 5 kilometers away maybe, and then shot it down within seconds. And I was, like, amazed by this piece of tech, and I said, you know, this must take the operator years to learn how to be that good. And he was like, it's an Xbox controller. He said, we give them like two hours of training on the system and how to use it. And he said within a day or two, they're knocking drones out of the sky from 5 kilometers away. Like, it's wow. You know, and so, you know, I guess warfare technology, all that sort of stuff is changing, and kids are growing up with it. Kids that are growing up programming and using computer games, and, like, you meet kids who know more about sniping details than I do, and that was actually what my job was, because they're playing it in Call of Duty or really? One of these other games.
I always wonder, yeah, I wonder what, how Call of Duty and stuff like that. I used to play, what was it called? Sniper Elite.
I've never played any of them, so
I mean, yeah, it's like, I did. I'm sure that you can have the settings set to, like, super realistic. Obviously, it's not realistic, but, like, you know, like, taking into account the wind and the drop and all that sort of stuff.
But so it's like a battle simulation, you know. It's yeah. You know, people can learn to fly an airplane or helicopter without taking off. So if you can do that, and the complex processes that are involved in flying rotary, then I'm sure you can do you know, simulated sniper shots in any condition, you know. And
So in case people don't know, you joined the army at 16.
Marines.
Royal Marines at 16. Passed, so is it 50 people and only 8 passed or 10 passed or something?
Yeah, that is, the rough figures are like 50 will join, sort of, and then out of that 8, 10, 12 will pass. So it's quite they used to have, and that's before that, you would have 50 that go onto a potential recruit course and maybe only 4 or 5 of them would be selected. Then you'd wait till you'd have 50 of those 4 or 5s, and then they would go into training, and then, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 of them would pass. So
if you fail it, can you do it again the next year?
I think you can. Yeah, I think you can. Like if you come out and you sort of leave, then, you know, generally, yeah, I would say probably a small percentage would come back and try it again. But the Marines had that advert, didn't they, a few years ago, that was like 99.9% need not apply. And that's actually what happened. They weren't applying because people were like, fuck that, it's too hard.
It's a really shit campaign to get people to apply. Yeah. The chances of you getting through are 0.1%.
Yeah.
I said this randomly. Who was I talking to? I can't remember. I think Noel Gallagher. And we said, like, if we're in the army, we'd be snipers. Yeah. I like that. And you say in the book that some soldiers consider it like you're sort of cheating a bit, you're hiding and sniping. But I just think, nah, that's... Because you have to dig in for ages, don't you? What's the longest you had to, like, hide somewhere?
Probably about 5 or 6 days, call it an observation post, but you know, you're sort of stuck in a hole in the ground effectively. Yeah. But you know the bit that I like about it is the fact that it's like what you're alluding to there, about being autonomous. You know, you're solely responsible for your own self. You're a sovereign individual, you know, that's it. And that's kind of what I liked. You know, you didn't have to have smart pressed trousers and all clean uniform and all, you know, all that sort of stuff. It was very the opposite.
Because you said in the book, like, snipers are allowed to have long hair.
Yeah, well, just generally, you're allowed to look a bag of shit because you're sort of out and doing your own thing, really. You're not sort of running around with the rest of the guys. So, but it's much more. And that's much more about, like, your ghillie suit and your shape and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And it's much more, you're not, you know, being a sniper is much more about being an individual and thinking for yourself and operating sort of in very small teams, you know, individually or in pairs, or sometimes fours. So you have much more autonomy on the battlefield, really, is what it's about. And you're ultimately more responsible for yourself than, you know. I just always like the fact that, you know, you sort of, you're responsible for what you're doing.
Yeah. Do you make your own ghillie suit then? Is that like really? I thought you just bought them. And
they do in America. They do. There's this massive market for, like, airsoft. People running around with old airsoft stuff, and they have these things that look, I mean, they're all right if you want to hide in a big ball of green string, you know, then it would look good. But, you know, like a ghillie suit is, you know, come actually, you know, as a sniper, you should be able to move across close with the enemy in any terrain without being seen, without wearing camouflage and, you know, ghillie suits and things. But, you know, it is an aid to camouflage and concealment. So it's basically, for anyone that doesn't know, it's like a thing that breaks up your head and shoulder shape, and you add camouflage to it in whichever environment you're in. So, you know, like if you're out in, I don't know, in the woods here, you would look at what's around you, sort of ferns and bits and pieces, and you stuff that all into it. So effectively, you're like a walking bush. But yeah, they're very much like, it's a you know, every one of those is a sniper's own piece of work, and you know, they make it themselves.
I'd definitely be a sniper because I'd love that. That's awesome. do you have what other weapons do you have? Like, you have a sidearm, so you've got your sniper rifle, but you just have what else do you have?
Your sniper rifle is, you know, it's a long barreled single shot rifle, so it's got a bolt action. So you can only fire one bullet at a time. So if you did get into a scrape, then it's, you know, and it's a big long barrel, then it's
useless.
You know,
yeah.
So you also carry a semi-automatic or, you know, automatic rifle. So you would carry, so you carry a rifle to get you out of the shit. And then you also have a pistol or a sidearm. So you're kind of
fucking up so much to carry.
And then all your other stuff, like whatever else you need to carry on the battlefield, grenades, mines, that sort of shit. So you end up being laid down, sort of laden down with all your operational kit. Although that is, to be fair, that's the same across the board with most soldiers.
Yeah.
But yeah, you are humping a shitload of kit around the battlefield.
That's crazy. And then so your sniper teams normally is two people, right? And you've got a...
Yeah, so you'd have like... The way they're traditionally set up is you have a sniper and you have a spotter. The spotter should be and is, you know, when you look at like the doctrine of it, should be the more experienced sniper because they're the one making the call. They're the one going through all the calculations and all the rest of that to make you able to then shoot. But in reality, the way it works is, you know, you'd work in a sniper pair, you'd have a trained sniper and then a marksman or another sniper that's doing your spotting. But you know, effectively, you're a force multiplier. You know, when you're sort of like one or two people, you can that are well placed and can place shots well. Then you sort of it's like having 10 people there, or 20 or 100 soldiers there. So it's
in the future, or maybe it exists now, but like I think I saw something about they were working on a system that as soon as the shot's fired, the computer can tell where it came from and return fire to that area. So
it already happens with tanks. You know, I'm out of date. You know, the battlefield changes so quickly and technology changes, but you know, even 15, 20 years ago, if you were to shoot at a tank, one of our tanks, I don't know what the tech is, but almost immediately that's returning fire to your exact location. So it's not taking a shot is not something that you want to be doing because it, you know, by the very mechanism of releasing a shot, the explosion, the noise, you know, any dust, any signature, then you're giving your position away. And you know that or even if you know, they couldn't find out where you are, they can just smash the entire area that you're in or certain specific areas that snipers might be operating in. So it's literally like the last thing that...
Do you change positions after shooting then?
Yeah, if it's possible, you would do. As soon as you've been compromised, as soon as you take a shot, you're compromised anyway. But really, you know, it's much more your eyes and ears. You're sort of passing information. That, you know, you're passing information is actually what you're doing. And, you know, all the skills like that, you know, I use sort of in my daily work. You know, if you're going working in a volcano, then you're sort of watching the patterns of life. It may not be of people, but you're watching patterns of life of the volcano or patterns of life of the river or the jungle. You know, it's about being in that environment and being super aware of that environment and what's going on round about it. So it's, you know, it's all about observation really.
Yeah. It's, well, I mean, like if you're was there a time, it's a difficult thing to talk about, but like the first time you have to like actually kill someone or, you know, take a shot that's going to kill someone, right? Is that a big moment, or is it just you're so trained, the infrastructure around you is so designed for that to be, or you know, like that's like a foregone conclusion, that's not a particularly big moment, or is that a big moment?
I mean, There's probably two answers to that. One is when you're there doing that job, and I can only speak from myself because every situation is different. You're kind of removed from the situation anyway.
Yeah.
You're by definition, you're usually on a flank or out, you know, at some distance, protecting eyes and ears, observing everyone else while they're working. So by kind of default, you're much more removed from it. Yeah. You know, it's not like you're going kicking doors down, and you know, which is something I've, you know, never done. So from my point of view, you're much more removed from it, and you're going through a process of you know, calculations and maths to make, you know, to make that shot connect. So really, I think I felt disconnected and away from it. It's you know, only in hindsight, probably much more, and that has to be the way with any soldiers in any situation, is that you know you've got a job to get on with, and that's effectively what you're doing. I think probably more so in hindsight, it's much more about working out what it was that you did and whether it was necessary, and you know, why were you even there in the first place, which is not a good thing to be questioning as a soldier. But I suppose to answer it, in a way, you're as a sniper, you're pretty far removed from it usually.
Yeah. I guess, like you say in the book, like the politics and the bigger picture, you can't really, that's just the worst thing to start thinking about because you've got a job to do. I suppose being in that situation as well, you're protecting your friends, you're protecting your
other. It's never been, I don't think, maybe I'm wrong speaking for myself, but I don't think anyone has gone to war for Queen and Country in a very long time. You know, it's, and the more you read about it and the more you understand about war fighting and the mechanisms that create war and why, and is it resources and things, you start to question the validity of why we're actually at war in a certain situation. So really, you're fighting for your mates that round about you and you know, nothing else, unless there's been a specific conflict, or you know, that has been helped by our intervention. But generally, war fighting is not good for any sides, apart from the advance of technology and creation of money.
Yeah,
and that's like skeptical of it all now.
a lot of those games, like Call of Duty, it's so easy. When they're Nazis, you're just like, right, well, fuck them, they're Nazis. Like, there must have been quite, you know, in the Second World War, the motivation that is unquestionable, because it's like, I mean, they didn't even realise what the Nazis were doing until afterwards, a lot, you know, the concentration camps and stuff. But, like, at least they were very clear baddies, you know. Yeah. So you've got that, like, there's no debate, these are baddies, they're invading other countries, they look bad, they're...
I mean, it's so difficult to know now. I mean, we're diving into, you know, how countries are run and what they're doing. But, like, is it for oil? Is it for what's underneath them? Is it for political power? Is it to silence or cause an uprising in a small country to draw attention from someone else or something else that's going on? It's never just now... And back then, probably it was never clear cut. I mean, I would imagine banks and central banks and things have got a lot to.
Yeah, it's mad, really, isn't it? Yeah, but you just go mad if you tried. You know, if you were aware of the bigger picture, you wouldn't be able to do your job.
And I think as a soldier, you know, I didn't really question that much. And even if I did, you know, what could I do? I'd get done for being AWOL or deserting. You know.
Yeah.
So you kind of. You know, you're not, I haven't and didn't at that time question it, but I suppose the older you get, the more you start to sort of think, what was the point of that? I mean, we've just come out of 20 years of fighting in Afghanistan, and what was the, you know, ultimately the position we're in now, what was the point of that and the loss of life across the board? And, you know, I think you'd, as a young soldier, it's probably better that I didn't think about that, otherwise I wouldn't have joined up, right?
Yeah. What do you think of global warming? Did you recently go to the North Pole?
Yeah, I was I just finished doing this big series, this expedition series with this James Cameron and BBC Studios sort of Blue Planet team. making this show called Ocean Explorers for National Geographic. And really, it's like a sort of modern day Jacques Cousteau. We go to an ocean, the Atlantic, on this series. And then we explore it on this amazing research vessel. So we were down in, and we've got two submarines on board, helicopter, you know, all the toys for scientific exploration, ROVs, science labs. And we sort of go to all these different locations and basically sort of explore them, you know, the animals, the wildlife, the pollutants, all that sort of stuff. And we just finished up in Svalbard, so north of Norway.
Mm.
And then we pushed on another up to 82 degrees north and a bit further past that, where traditionally the ice, the sea ice would have been, you know, which covers from the North Pole down. We managed to get to within about 460, 70, 80 miles from the North Pole. And so, yeah, the scientists that we were working with there were, you know, that there is no conversation about it. You know, the climate is changing and it's getting warmer and the sea ice is melting. Here's the proof. So you kind of get to see it. Yeah, you get to see. They reckon within, that scientist that I was working with reckons within 15 years, 15 or 20 years, there'll be no sea ice in the North Pole over summer, which means you can, I mean, I think the Russians are already smashing through it and with nuclear powered sort of icebreakers, but you know that opens up a whole ocean up there which has traditionally been, you know, inaccessible. So what resources lie underneath that? I mean, it's quite scary,
because I was reading about it today, like they say, you know, like it's very hard to get your head around the science of it, because when they say, oh, there'll be a 3 degree rise around the world, you sort of think, well, you know, 3 degrees, you wouldn't feel, well, you would feel it slightly, wouldn't you, but it's the difference between going outside and it's 12 degrees and 15 degrees. You wouldn't, it's not catastrophic, but obviously that is the beginning of a massive snowball effect of just rampant.
It's all of it is a negative feedback loop. You know, I'm not a climate scientist, but I get to work with, you know, a lot of them when we're doing these expeditions. But
they're all just like, oh no, this is real and it's bad.
Yeah, there is no chat. There is no, right, you know, what the chat is about is politics and economy. And you know, that's why, I mean, we could, you know, you could ban, for example, the use of plastic bags overnight in the UK. You know, it's a small part, right? But there are certain things that we saw it with COVID. You know, the government can just stop or change, do anything they want if the impetus is there. But climate change is hard to see, and it's hard to look at the ocean and think that it's not all okay. You know, you go down to the beach and you look out into the Atlantic and you think, well, that's beautiful, and there's some dolphins there. And you know, it's hard to see what the problems are, and a 3 degree rise in water temperature means that more ice is melting on, you know, certainly on the North Pole and ice caps in Greenland, which means there is less white reflecting heat back, which means it then heats up more. You know, I'm probably sound flippant talking about it in that sort of bigger picture, but essentially, you know, we're having a huge effect on the planet. And one scientist that I was working with was like, well, you know, the planet eventually will work itself out and be fine, but we'll be long gone, like as a human race, we'll be either dead or on another planet.
I feel like the oil companies and the traditional fuel, you know, like fossil fuel system 50 years ago, they knew this was happening and sort of thought, you know, like, well, it's kind of what we're going through now. It's like, well, if we stop, we lose a lot of money and everyone else carries on making money. And so they sort of just kicked it down the road, thinking we'll be dead by the time this is a problem, those particular people. Yeah. And now it seems like China, if they don't see it in Russia, don't seem to be as keen to control their output carbon dioxide wise or whatever. And so emissions wise, so they can carry on. Like, we'll take a financial hit, economic hit, and then because their population can't exactly vote them out and tell them, you know, protect the planet. It's like, we're kind of trapped because they're not going to really change. So as we could do everything, and then we're still going to.
It's also you know, my view on it as well is that it's all right for us to sit in a very developed country and talk about climate change and, you know, or protecting animals, for example. We're going to create a game reserve here and kick all the local people out just, you know, to protect animals. You know, we do have human security to think about, you know, and who are we to sit here and say that someone in a developing country in you know, the continent of Africa can't have electricity or can't have fresh running water, which it comes from another process, which is, you know, creating problems in the environment. So it's, you know, we are 300-500 years of kicking the can down the street and suddenly realizing that actually we, you know, we can't live like this. But you can't then make everyone say, well, we'd like to, right? But how can you stop people having that human security of fresh water, electricity, heat?
It's going to lead to wars, isn't it? That's the problem.
I mean, resources are the biggest cause of resource, and religion probably are the biggest causes of war. So you've got like borders, you've got ores, like minerals, oil. Yeah. Oil is probably one of the biggest gas natural reserves.
In your accent, I was like, ores,
oil.
Yeah, all that weird mineral shit in Africa that the Chinese are going after, and you know, that's I don't really understand that. But like mineral rich countries, because people didn't seem to. It was all about oil, wasn't it? Now it's like minerals are really important.
Well, it's like you know, the smartphone has in the screen the it has a mineral called coltan. And that it's, I think, to do with the conductivity of it. So all smart screens have coltan in it, whether it's you know, whether it's an iPad, a laptop, you know, they have coltan in it. And coltan is mined in a couple of places in the world, but for example, DRC, you know, and so everyone's pushing for the latest phone. You've got ex-child soldiers or kids that are in mines in Africa digging out coltan, or you know, probably the same for batteries, you know, for electric cars. Where is the lithium coming from? Who's mining it? What's that process like? How do you mine it? Is it friendly? What happens to all the batteries at the end? So, you know, we have to go through these processes to, you know, we're always going to advance. This is quite big subjects, but we're always going to advance. And it becomes like quite hard as a human race to not leave an imprint on the planet, I think.
Yeah, sort of like it started before we were born, and it's because it's like, I don't know, what pisses me off, it's like the people in control have created a situation and then let it get out of hand, and then it's now the people in control telling the people, oh, you've got to change this and you've got to do this, and you know, sort of as if we were aware. And I suppose, you know, it's not like we were completely unaware, but the way the world's set up, it's like you couldn't, you know, 10 years ago say, I'm not going to drive a car because, you know, if you're like, it's like you're saying, it's like everyone's trying to survive. And if you need to get to work and you need to feed your kids, in your short-term problems override the fact that, oh, this car's not great for the planet. It's like, I don't know. It seems like, I was kind of hoping you'd say, nah, it's like bollocks. It's like... but you've seen it melting. You've seen the actual.
We get to see it firsthand, and it's, you know, it's across the board in almost every country. You know, there are. My wife was out doing a project in Kiribati, which I think is spelt Kiribati, and they're having, you know, I think if I get the story right, it's the first like climate refugees. You know, they're having to move because Kiribati is being flooded. The sea level is rising above where they live. So the people in these countries that have the least output in creating the least imprint on the planet are the first generally to be, you know, moving. And they're having to buy land. I think the Kiribati government is buying land in Hawaii to then rehome people from, you know, that, you know, and once that happens in places like the UK, you know, people are having to move their home from the shores of, you know, the sea in Brighton and Devon and Cornwall, and, you know, the cliffs are already eroding, you know, it's then it then becomes our problem. But it's the same as everything. If you can't see it from your house, does it really matter? And that's, you know, the same as when you look in the ocean, does it matter? You know, does it matter that it's full of chemicals and plastic if you can't see it? And, you know, whether everything, what people think, if everything died in there, does it matter to them and their life in London, in Glasgow, wherever? I don't know, man, it's a massive subject. I guess COP26 and stuff that's going on now is it's pretty important.
Yeah, it seems like it's sort of futile slightly. But when you were crossing the Atlantic, did you see a load of, was there a litter and plastic out there? Or
yeah, I mean, you see, you get these areas which like gyres, it's effectively where currents meet, and it brings the ocean's worth of trash into to that one spot, and some of them are kilometers wide. We did a night dive recently in the Azores, and there's a big current meeting there, and we were diving through plastic bags and stuff that's flip-flops and all sorts of stuff that's you know, just makes its way into the rivers, so, and then into the oceans. But
I saw this thing, there's a boat now that it basically drags a huge net. Did you see that? It was like, there's this thing on Instagram, like good news stories. And one of them was this thing that picked up like huge amount of plastic waste, which they can now recycle. But it was, I mean, there is like some hope, I suppose. But
ghost nets are a big one. In fact, I was up in Svalbard recently when we were, the amount of reindeer carcasses that you see dead with their heads wrapped in fishing nets. So the fishing nets drift in the sea, they get washed up onto the beach, the reindeer come down, get their heads stuck in it, and end up being killed by a polar bear or die just because their head's all wrapped up. And it was weird to see so many of them. And you think that, like, these nets were designed to catch fish in the sea, not reindeers on land. But that's effectively what it was doing. But like you say, you know, that there's a massive movement. What we got to hope is our kids are, you know, they're going to be the ones that are dealing with it. And you know, as hard as it is, you know, they're going to have to be the ones that are pushing for the change, because all the old people in power and that have had it, you know, been getting away with it for years, aren't going to be doing these changes or pushing them.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a bit depressing, isn't it?
But yeah, a little bit.
Good thing we've had kids. They can sort it out.
Yeah, let them do it.
When you came out of the army, you know, like the part of the book where you're kind of lost and you had to do the birdie dance to get a sales job and stuff like that. How does it feel? It seems like there is some support for soldiers who leave and then, you know, going back into civilian life. But do you feel like you're kind of just ditched once you're no use to them?
In a way, you sort of come out and you've had this support network behind you for you know, however long that you've been in, but and you come out and you're very on your own. And when I left, there wasn't all the sort of support networks available that there are now, and it was kind of expected that you just got out and you got on with it and you were successful. But it's becoming more and more obvious that isn't the case, and there are, you know, people that are, especially after 20 plus years of fighting, you know, there are a lot of people that aren't okay that are leaving the military, and I'm not, you know, I'm a bit out of the loop with all of that and what support's there, and but you know, people, soldiers, men and women are still killing themselves you know, very regularly, more so than probably people understand or know, and that's something that shouldn't be happening. So you know, I think the support probably wasn't there when I left, but you know, it was changed times. You know, it's 20 years on, we should be supporting and looking out for soldiers.
It's mad because, like, my friend, what was he in, Paris, but that he came out and got a job in the city in banking because they highly prized ex-military, because they were like, they turn up on time, they work, they, you know, they're just fucking good workers because they've got that mentality. So I suppose, like, there should be like, and they might, this probably does exist, but like recruitment agencies that take, because at least if you hire someone who's ex-army, you know they're going to be there on time, they're going to do, you know, they're good teamwork, they've got like all that skill. Yeah. Such a shame that people come out with that high level of training and then end up, I mean, you know,
but I mean, there's a big percentage of people and homeless people in London, you know, yeah, they're ex-military, and people do realize the sort of strength and capacity of a military person, male or female, in the civilian workplace. And it's, you know, people in banking, for example, love military people because they are not just on time, but it's also about their how they analyze risk, keeping a cool head under pressure, yeah, you know, all these things, which, you know, banking, I guess, for one, can be hell of a stressful. So there's quite a lot, actually, of military people doing that sort of line of work because of that. But it's something that always people want to make happen. But the reality of it is that once you're out, you're kind of on your own.
I mean, you did well, but you tried loads of different things, didn't you? But you were always training and learning new skills, like the abseiling type stuff. And
I went offshore and did, you know, I was interested in the outdoors. The military gave me this big load of skills, basically. And so I sort of switched that into like what I do now, working in TV. You know, I was rope access for a while offshore on oil rigs. And I was just using that time that I was off, 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, to effectively carve out a new niche or a new career for me, and which is what kind of happened with adventure television, you know, needing safety people who were jack of all trades but could look after like a crew, you know, what film crews, yeah, can be like in some places, very creative and focused on the narrative as opposed to the practicalities of you've got eight people in a jungle and it's, you know, it's pissing down.
Yeah.
I feel like I've sort of carved out quite a good niche there. But like you say there about coming out of the military, it took a while to get there. And also it was much more about realizing that I was then the main person responsible for whether I'd be successful or not. You know, there was no one going to come and help get to that position. So a lot of it was about, understanding the opportunities there and being able to work out how to access them. I was going to say, I've got a physio appointment at 11:30. Do you reckon we've still got quite a bit to go?
Well, no, I normally do about 2 hours, but you don't have to do that. I can, when can you go till?
It's probably going to take me 20 minutes to get this, or 5 minutes, but I can,
yeah.
Is that cool?
Yeah.
I should have actually said that beforehand. Or
I should have said that, like, that they go long sometimes. But like,
that's all right. I love that.
Yeah. Let's quickly talk about the transatlantic thing, because what made me laugh is like you're always talking about the preparation and everything, and that sounded pretty shambolic, really.
Yeah, pretty loose. We rolled.
No tea and coffee was the heartbreaking thing.
Oh man. That was dire. But we, Foxy and I and three other guys decided to row across the Atlantic. And we were going to row from La Gomera in Portugal from Lagos in Portugal all the way across to Venezuela. So it hadn't been done before. And it was in a sort of a little rowing boat. And I'm the smallest of the guys. I'm pretty small, but the other guys are all big old lumps.
Yeah.
We did do a fair bit of planning for it with regards to like the route we knew we were going to go west, basically. But we can't, I don't know, it was maybe that supreme confidence.
We knew we were going to go west.
It was that kind of like supreme confidence of, you know, we'd all been in the military, or, you know, Foxy, SBS, and
yeah,
you know, and it was just going to be hard work for however long it took. But I don't think any of us really expected that it would have taken us, you know, close to 2 months or, you know, 50 days.
2 months. It sounded awful. It sounded like getting the shark, like getting knocked into the water, the sores on your ass, like Foxy.
the whole thing was, you know, it took us 50 days, 10 hours and 36 minutes. The same sort of journey would take you like a 10 hour flight or something, maybe 12 hours. And you know, the whole thing was, it was amazing in a way that it just taught you almost complete mindfulness, you know, because that, you know, if you imagine you row for 2 hours and then you're off for 2 hours, but you can't go anywhere, you can't do anything. And then you row for 2 hours and then you're off for 2 hours. And then that is your routine for almost 2 months.
Well, you know, so was there not an idea of like some people row and someone sleeps for like 6 hours or like a night's sleep? You just, that must have, I'd go there mad.
We messed around, yeah. In the early days, we messed around trying to work out like how you could give someone time off, but it just never. The best way of doing it was 2 hours on, 2 hours off, and that was it.
Yeah.
It was just too messy and too. And once you start getting to that situation of, say, for example, mid-Atlantic, you know, just a big capsize. Tim Peakin's space station was like the closest human being to us. And so at that point, you know, things, you know, someone's getting a little bit extra time off more than you, or someone's getting a little bit extra food more than you, or a bit more sleep, you know, that gets stuck under the microscope and life can become quite difficult. So it was much more about, you know, about keeping it even and the same for everyone across the board. But yeah.
Do you think that was the closest to death you've been from all your experiences?
I mean, for me personally, you know, we capsized and it was very scary, but I was still attached to the boat. One of the guys wasn't, but he didn't get washed out, which, you know, thankfully, you know, was a good thing. But I think it was one of the most amazing things that we've done because we were on our own. Like, we really were on our own. We unsupported, and it was just one of those things that it was like, bloody hell, we're rowing across the, not just the ocean, but the planet in a rowing boat.
What do you do when you arrive? Like, do you feel, what was the feeling? Obviously there's some elation, but then do you sort of think, oh, we did it. What do we do now?
Kind of the anticlimax came, you know, 2 or 3 weeks after that. And it stayed for 2 or 3 months until I did my next job. You know, I was kind of off and feeling a bit lost and after it. And, but yeah, when you get in, you're just utterly bollocks. I was pretty whacked on tramadol at that point, because I had a lot of pain going on, so it was all just a bit of a blur, really. But
how good does the first like bath and sleep in a hotel bed feel?
Mate, I was in amazing the first time the first time you go to bed, you haven't slept more than an hour and a half in any straight stretch for 2 months. So I remember standing in a shower drinking a bottle of beer and just thinking, this is amazing. Yeah, first shower in 2 months.
Jesus. And then did you like never want to see the others again for a bit?
Mate, we're all good mates, but yeah, we had a bit of time out. but we're, you know, we're all super good mates and you know, still in touch. You know, but the big thing was we raised a lot of money, like $250,000 for the NSPCC. That was the, you know, we were all doing it for ourselves, really, for getting away from whatever was going on in their own lives and just getting stuck into rowing. But you know, we did also raise quite a lot of money for the charities.
Yeah. That's pretty good. I know you want to go, but like, I do have the, what I loved in the book was the chewing gum removal business that you need. Taken off and that was who you were. That's why I was talking to you. Mr. Chewing Gum.
That would have been mad. Yeah, it was like $4,000 machine. I'd like saved up from being offshore, and I think I only used it once. It's like a sort of
Like a water jet thing?
Like a steamer. So it just like steamed a little bits of chewing gum off, and I only ever did like one or two jobs with it. Got paid about $400 or $500, but actually, it was the first time that I sort of started thinking about business and about work and about how to not just work for a day rate, if that makes sense. It certainly wasn't my passion, but yeah, it was good. It was not like doing the chicken dance and selling the gas and electricity, but you kind of like, when you leave the Marines, you kind of do these, like, until you find out what your passion and purpose is, you feel a bit lost. Mm-hmm. I met a guy yesterday, a mate who was a good mate in the Marines, and he was saying the same thing. You know, he had this cushy job all set up when he got out, but he just didn't have the passion or purpose anymore. Yeah. And it didn't matter how much money he was getting paid. He wanted a job that gave him that passion and purpose again, which is, you know, it's good food for thought, really, for people generally that are banging their heads off a brick wall with work and jobs and careers and things, is that if it's not your passion and it's not making you truly interested, then what is, and how can you make that like your work? How can you earn from it?
Yeah, no, it's good. It is good advice. And it's like, I think you're restless, especially like ex-military people. It's like, this isn't good enough. This isn't exciting. And so, you know, most people just sort of go, oh, it's all right. It's fine. They get through the day, you know, but I think there is something to be learned there, not just about controlling fear and stuff, but like being brave in the sense of like, does this make me truly happy? No, then I need to do something else, even if it's a risk.
Yeah, I think, you know, being courageous, you know, the commando spirit, you know, that you get taught in the Marines when you join is like courage, determination, unselfishness, cheerfulness in the face of adversity. But that courage now, you know, isn't about jumping out in front of a hail of bullets or anything like that. You know, to me, that courage now is about doing the right thing for yourself. You know, like, like you say, is this job making me happy? If not, you know, and I've effectively only got 30 more years of being alive or being useful to society, then why am I wasting my time? You know, because, and it's, you know, it sounds a bit morbid, but, you know, like your first 20 years, you're on the piss, aren't you?
Yeah.
Mainly fucking around, and maybe 25, 30 years. And then you've got a bit in the middle where you graft hard and you should work hard at whatever your thing is. And then you have the bit at the end where you're, you know, potentially not that much use to anyone. So it's like, you don't actually have that much useful time to get stuck in and find your passion and find that thing that, you know, when you're just about to take your last breath, you go, that was mega, you know, I did everything that I wanted to, or fuck, I just wasted that.
I was scared of that, like that reflection, but like I think you'll be all right. Shit, why didn't we row back across it?
Like, yeah. The funny thing about the rowing back across Atlantic, when Foxy and I went down to do the Narcos thing in South America, the Popeye, who's Pablo Escobar's sort of like main hitman, found out, he did his research and he found out that we did the row, and he was asking all these questions about the boat. And we were like, Foxy and I, like, this is weird. And then at the end of the conversation, he was like, Emma, what's the sort of weight load that you can get in one of these boats? And do you think you could roll back?
Fucking hell, imagine you were doing that.
Yeah, mega.
Pretty good pay, but it wouldn't be going to the NSPCC.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, mate. Well, thanks for chatting to me. And I love the book. It's very good. And I think everyone should read it. I think there's something in there for everyone.
Thank you, mate. Really appreciate that. And sorry I had to bail early, mate.
That's all right, mate. I
do apologize.
Awesome. That's right. Thanks a lot, dude. Cheers.
Cheers, man. See you
later. Bye. So that was Aldo Kane. What a fascinating gentleman. I like the way that his camera was set up, so it looked like I was laying in his lap as he was talking to me. His laptop was down low, as you just saw. If you're watching the video, if you see the audio, you wouldn't have known this, but it looked like he was talking down and I was curled up in his lap saying, "Tell me about the war, Daddy." But that was him. I hope you enjoyed it. See you soon.